So we have very little evidence on interventions that are used in large scale across entire populations, entire countries, much of the world in the setting of pandemic like COVID-19. And this is really concerning. The evidence gap is replaced by other types of data, lots of modeling data, and some observational data. And without wishing to dismiss this type of information, we have to be very cautious because they do have lots of limitations. Modeling is lots of fancy attempts, and I enjoy it myself, but it's unfortunately making by default a lot of assumptions, and these assumptions may or may not hold true. And therefore, you just don't know much of the time whether the inferences of these models are trustworthy. In fact, we have seen even within the first several months of the pandemic that the vast majority of the modeling that has been done has not really been able to get realistic predictions and inferences. And some of the modeling has led even to very misleading inferences because people trust too much these predictions, and they act based on them as if they were very strong evidence, where actually they're very weak evidence. Now, some models also use more data than others. Some are more data-driven and less assumption-driven, but even those that are more data-driven, these data are observational. They occur in a very unstable environment of an evolving epidemic wave. They should be seen with a lot of caution and not easily extrapolated. Clearly, realizing that we don't have good evidence is the first step. It takes some brave people and some brave statements to really push that point that we don't have evidence. You need to convince others who say, I don't care, I just need to do something because we have a serious situation here, and forget about evidence, I'm just going to act. But obviously, this can work for a very acute situation that is an acute disaster, but for a condition that is likely to last for months and years, saying that we will just follow our gut feeling and these modeling and observational data as they come, I think is a recipe for disaster. And I think that we have a very high risk of doing a lot of harm unless we just say we don't have evidence. Let's get evidence that is trustworthy as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, a lot of evidence is not shared for various reasons. There's a huge literature on publication bias, on selective reporting, on why that happens, on the incentives for sharing data that sometimes are focusing more on sharing extravagant, extreme, significant results, and lots of more modest, moderate results, non-significant results do not get to be disseminated. Sometimes there's conflicts of interest. In the case of a pandemic, you have like a complete mess of very fast-moving science, peer review being subverted, probably by zealots sometimes, who want to accept papers that fit their worldview immediately and not accept or destroy papers that are proving that their thoughts and ideas and ideologies are wrong. So these biases that exist, and we have very well documented them along many, many decades across biomedicine and other scientific fields, when it comes to the urgent setting of a pandemic, I think that they can really get worse. In COVID-19, media and even more social media really took control of science to a large extent. And that's very unfortunate because these are people who are not trained most of the time to really cover science. We've seen a deficit of science journalism even in the past. There were very few journalists who knew about science. Also, many scientists, in a way, became media agents during the pandemic. I know of many highly respectable colleagues who became social media animals. Social media are not necessarily a place to have balanced scientific discussion. They have the benefit of rapidity and of some sort of unhindered expression, which is great. But at the same time, it creates a situation where science is shaped and approved or disapproved by large mobs rather than careful thinking, proofs, evidence. You have people who can tweet away more than their opponents, who can harness a larger crowd of followers, and also journalists who can really shape a given reality of evidence, which may have very little to do sometimes with real evidence. Yes, that editorial I wrote to express my concern about using machineries that are not part of scientific method, but part of activism and advocacy to replace the scientific method. I've seen many scientists who somehow in their tweets and in their open letters, in their social engagement, they say, many people, many scientists agree with me, and my opponents, they're just fringe people. They belong to, they're pseudoscientists, even worse. And, you know, pseudoscientists may include Nobel laureates and extremely talented scientists and some of the top methodologists in the world. So it creates a very explosive mix when you get scientists behaving as activists or advocates. And collecting signatures is probably one such example. I'm perfectly fine with collections of signatures when it comes to ethical issues like people being fired or, you know, some ethical issue in the community that needs to be settled with mobilization of opinion. But saying that I have one scientific theory that I will prove it because I have collected enough signatures, this is completely ridiculous. I think that Copernicus would have collected one signature and he would have had probably thousands of quote-unquote scientists in his era saying that his heliocentric model was entirely wrong. Einstein in 1905, again, he would have a single vote for his new theories. And if you were to ask everyone else, they would say they hadn't heard about it or that would be completely wrong and they would be wrong. The third point is the involvement of politics, which makes things even worse. I have felt that science has had kind of a difficult relationship to politics. Ideally, you want science to inform society and leadership in making decisions. This is the ideal situation when good science based on good evidence is informing the decisions of our society. And obviously, these decisions will be made in most circumstances by politicians or other types of leaders. However, you reach the situation where you may see that politics is subverting science, that politics is taking control of science in different ways. And what we have seen in the COVID-19 setting, we have seen that scientific positions were espoused by specific entities in the political divide. If you were to claim that you believe in X, you would be immediately classified as conservative or progressive or Trump supporter or Biden supporter. And again, I think this is completely ridiculous because science is not dictated by politicians, by parties, should not be an issue of political divide. We all struggle to find the truth, to come as close to the truth as possible, to minimize error, to minimize bias, to get rid of existing biases, first of all, we need to detect them. So having that whole political turmoil superimposed on science really creates a very difficult situation. And obviously then you get all the methods of politics, including lobbying, including subversion, including smearing of opponents, including fake news, including social media campaigns, including distorted journalism that are infused into science. That can be devastating. I think science is very delicate. If you start treating it with such doses of poisons of that sort, science is dying. And you know what you're left with is just angry, opinionated experts at each other's throat, which is not what science should be at any point by any means. So we have very little evidence that mandatory or enforced restraints are doing any good. So especially in the setting of ensuing fatigue, I don't have evidence for that, but I can bet that it's more likely that they will do more harm than good. I think that they will create even more fatigue. I think that they will probably damage even more mental health and other adverse consequences of that whole setting. I think that these are things that we need to study, because otherwise we end up in a situation where many governments and leaders are kind of announcing new measures every week, if not every day, and just following some non-reliable indicators like number of cases, which of course depend on how many people you test. And whenever they see a spike or an increase, they feel pressured to impose even more measures, as if that would do anything, although we have no evidence that all these minute variants of aggressive or more aggressive measures really would be helpful. So I think that in principle, I'm not in favor of legal enforcement and policing. I think that I'm willing to get pushback on this, and I would like to see pushback generated with some reliable evidence. And ideally that could include randomized trials as we discussed at the very beginning. But I'm worried that the balance of benefits and harms, we know so much about the potential harms in terms of absolute magnitude, even though they may not be accurate. If we're talking about 50% of the population becoming infested with anxiety or depression and 25% of young people having suicidal ideation, even if this is like 50% off and our estimates are not accurate, you would need a tremendous benefit of these legal enforcements to even match this, let alone all the other adverse consequences. So off the start, I think that these aggressive legal enforcements seem very problematic to me. I think that many people do feel insulted. They feel that their freedom is restrained, that their very fundamental rights are restrained. You know, what would a dictatorship do more? I don't think that any dictatorship has managed to really restrain life as much as some of the lockdowns have by a large margin of difference. So I'm not a conspirator theorist or anything, I think that people who apply these measures are well intentioned, but I don't think that they consider the horrible perception that many people get out of these measures. Now there's other people who might feel that not taking measures is a sign of weakness of their leaders. So one needs to balance these two perspectives. You know, people who say, you know, please shut down everything, we're dying. And you have the counter argument here that some of these leaderships feel that they need to respond to that quest for maximal measures. But I think that this is getting to the point of some sort of psychopathology. And we know that even under normal circumstances, a very large share of the population has phobias for pathogens. In the current setting, where we have a virus that has been trumpeted wide and right and left as the major pandemic of the century, you know, these phobias become very dominant in the population, and I think that they can be devastating. So the risk to the vast majority of people is completely negligible. There are some people who have devastating risk, of course. I think that, as I mentioned at the very beginning, lots of the decisions about COVID-19 were based on modeling studies, and their track record has not been very good. Their track record actually was not very good even in the past, even before COVID-19, but somehow the implications were not so serious. You know, most people would not really realize that models were so wrong, because the consequences of the modeling would not affect their lives. They would not affect them, their choices, their options. In the current situation, modeling has changed their lives in major ways. And I think that the failures of modeling have become very obvious, and their consequences can be really devastating. We know that modeling is one useful contributor to our understanding of evidence. So I'm not saying to completely discredit it. I think that we can work towards making it more transparent, more feasible to understand how it works, so that other people can test and reproduce its machinery. Many models are black boxes that people cannot even see how they work and why they get the inferences that they get. Giving enough room for the uncertainty that is involved in the assumptions, in the data that are fed into the model, and therefore also in the output of the models. I think many people, leaders, politicians, policymakers, but also scientists in this pandemic showed that they had no clue how unreliable modeling is. They just took these numbers at face value. They looked at the plots. They had very nice colors, and they looked very scary. And they just said, well, this is science. No, this is not science. This is one weak form of science, among the weakest probably that we have. And I think that this was not realized. This led to a lot of confusion. It led to very wrong expectations. It led to wrong decisions. For example, when people were thinking that they would get 10 times more patients coming to the hospital, they sent already infected COVID-19 patients from the hospitals to nursing homes, and then they devastated the nursing homes. So wrong models in COVID-19 was not just another failure of modeling. You know, this has been a very long track record of mostly failures. It was something that led to people dying. And I think this is really horrible. And we should find ways to avoid it. Unfortunately, major institutions, universities, major journals, they still trust a lot of modeling that is very unreliable. They publish lots of it, probably with very sketchy peer review, among other modelers who are just willing to promote and self-promote this type of work. I think it's becoming kind of a mafia. And I'm not saying this to I'm saying it more in a laughing way rather than in a derogatory way. But I think these major journals and institutions should realize that modelers are not what they seem to be. I think that there's personal responsibility for everyone. I think that personal responsibility is a feature of human life. When it comes to professionals in public health, of course, it takes an extra dimension, because there's a sense that they can make a difference in especially in crisis times, but even in normal times. I think we need to see this with some temperance, however, and avoid becoming advocates that forget about evidence and they're just out there to save the world. I think it's wonderful to save lives, to save the world, but the path to error is usually led by good intentions. And I worry that many people in public health are very weak in research methodology. They're very not well prepared in terms of understanding evidence and especially the limitations of evidence. Many of them have very strong beliefs, and this means that often they go into war without really knowing what they're doing. What we have seen in COVID-19 is also that many people who were not even involved in public health took the role of public health professionals. We saw the major newspapers and media really flooded with people who had no clue about public health, let alone evidence and research methods, who really took up to themselves to save the world. And this is really scary. We saw also lots of scientists who either have no training in public health and methods, or have some, but it's very incomplete and very unilateral. They also took very maximalistic positions. I think this is, again, very scary, because in cases of crisis, you need to have complementarity. You need to have multiple people from different ways of life with different expertise, with very strong methods training that would try to give a very balanced perspective. And of course, act. I'm not saying not to act, but act in a responsible way that would maximize the ratio of benefit to harm. I don't think that this has happened, unfortunately, in the COVID-19 crisis.